and welcome to the Original Content Podcast. I'm Anthony Ha.
I'm Daryl Etherington.
And we are joined today by Natasha Mascarenhas. She is joining us from San Francisco. You told me that before, and then I totally blanked on it. She is, of course, a writer at TechCrunch, and you may also recognize her voice from the Equity podcast. Natasha, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys. I'm excited for this one.
And this week, we're going to review Never Have I Ever. It's a new series on Netflix. Before we do that, I wanted to touch on one piece of kind of fun news if you're not Jeffrey Katzenberg or a Quibi employee, which is
How fun is this? Is it just mean news?
I guess it's mean news. I'm sorry. I think it was a fun discussion in our chat room, and I do sort of enjoy talking about it, but I don't want to make light of other people's stress and pain, but I suppose we're going to do that a little bit, which is the Jeffrey Katzenberg, who is the founder of Quibi. He is a longtime Hollywood executive, gave an interview with the New York Times today. And it's sort of unusual because a company, especially a startup that's having a tough time, it's really rare for them to admit that things aren't going well.
Yeah.
Except when they actually make the pivot. If they're like, oh, we launched this new thing and then we realized the old thing that we were saying was really great for 6 months was bad, and now we're launching a new thing. But he just sort of gives this mid-course acknowledgement that it didn't go the way he planned, and he blames all of it on coronavirus.
Right.
Basically, the idea that because everyone's at home, it doesn't make sense for people to watch Quibi anymore, but he's hoping that when this is over, it'll all work out. Daryl, what do you think of that?
Well, I mean, he had the funny pivot. It's a great New York Times article. Everyone should read it. It has a wonderful kicker too. I forget exactly what it is, but it's like sort of just like, you know, I think it's a quote kicker and it's a bad quote. But the funny part that it, for me, was that he blames it all on coronavirus, and then immediately says, "But we own it," which doesn't. I mean, yes, you do, because you're on the hook for it money-wise. Is that what you mean? But it was weird. And I saw somebody characterize it. I wish I could cite this, but like somebody on Twitter characterized it as, you know, they caught him sort of on the phone, unprepared, uncoached. And 100%. Then if you saw, because I think somebody interviewed Meg Whitman like as a follow-up, and she was like, things are going great. We're very happy with our download numbers, blah, blah, blah. And it was like the polished, coached executive response like a day later or 2 days later or whatever, right? So I feel for him. I mean, we've had a lot of fun at Quibi's expense on this show, I think. But, you know, it was always a long bet. I think that there was a lot of trust in Katzenberg's reputation, especially on the content side. And he put together an amazing slate in terms of just names, right? Like the names that were involved were huge. I mean, you can never know what it would be like if it didn't land during a coronavirus, which is the convenient thing, right? But like, I don't know that it would have made much of a difference. I mean, for sure, had it had some kind of like TV viewing thing, I think that would have helped it a little bit. I don't think that would have absolutely changed the game in this instance. I think the approach they tried was novel in that they tried something new, but I think there's something fundamentally broken about the way they just, and I talked about this before, but the way they just like sliced up these things that clearly seem much more traditional and longer form in terms of how they're structured into whatever they thought was like a bite-sized modern adaptation. Like, it doesn't seem made that way. It's a fusion of the old and the new, and I think it's more about the form than it is about the content delivery method, right?
I feel like Quibi was like already limping the moment it went out the gate. Like, people were just waiting to make the jokes.
Yeah.
I mean, to your point, I think like we will never know what it would have been like without a pandemic, but I do know that like a lot of people weren't, at least like VC Twitter and all the jokesters, including ourselves, were not, for myself, wasn't necessarily like rooting for it.
I think that's
on
fair.
The cusp of something great. Like, everyone was kind of waiting to make a joke about it. It definitely screamed lack of media training to me, which is obviously always exciting for reporters, but I'm sure they're really biting their tongue right now. I felt so bad. I was like, oh no, this is 101. Don't say this.
I wonder about that, because to me, I feel like Katzenberg is somebody who has to know, you know, like he's been around the block many times. Yeah. And my assumption was that this was a specific decision that they made of like, okay, everyone is making fun of us, or mostly actually everyone has forgotten that we launched a month ago. And so we need to sort of go out, but we can't just say everything's great because people aren't idiots. And so we have to acknowledge it. But I don't know, maybe he thought it was just going to be a much more softball interview, and then he ended up sliding into being a little bit more honest than he should have been.
Wait, but is your other theory that it's the 3D chess type move? Like they're like, let's make another news moment and have Katzenberg
go
off
like
the
rail? Not like 3D chess, but just, I don't think she like randomly called him up. I think either their PR team or the Times reporter pitched them on a story and said, hey, like, we'd love to sort of get caught up on where Quibi is now and what are the... I don't think it was completely spontaneous. I think it was something that was planned, and then maybe he talked about it in a way that they were not expecting.
I think it like opened up a conversation about how many companies are doing this right now where they're blaming coronavirus when that's not the problem at hand.
Yeah.
And I'm waiting for like that story to be written, because I'm like, it's really frustrating when you see like layoffs happening and you kind of know that it's not just coronavirus, but now every company has an excuse for why they're not doing well. So I was like, oh, okay, another tally mark.
Yeah, it's happening. It's tough. And I mean, I think we've all had experiences of that specific phenomenon on our beat that we at least suspect, even if we can't 100% verify. We can say whatever we want on this podcast because no one listens to it, so it's fine. But like some actual examples from space that I'm very happy to talk about, like the Intelsat just declared bankruptcy. They filed for Chapter 11, and they really aggressively marketed it as a turnaround, a financial restructuring in the vein of like GM's bankruptcy declaration, like up front, which is a bold move, a weird move, but a bold move. And then another one that happened, and they didn't do this in the same way, was OneWeb, which was another like really well capitalized, they were a SoftBank company, and they blamed it. And like, of course, yes, it probably had an accelerating effect, and there's no doubt about that, but it's not like they weren't already on people's radars as companies that had big liquidity problems prior to that, right? So I think it's definitely one of those things where it's like, this is a scapegoat, and it feels cheap to address it in, you know, like in an article. It feels kind of like, why would you even bother going out? Like, all these people lost their jobs. Like, sure, they had liquidity problems, but does it matter now, right? Like, and it kind of does, because it's like, let's make sure the people that are following our advice, like, don't go down the same path again for a similar company in future, right? But like, it does feel a bit like kicking a dead horse or whatever, right? So, you know, I get the reluctance, and I also get the for them, I get the like desire to do that, right? And to lean on that and bring it in as a factor.
And so getting back to Quibi for one second, I mean, do you, either of you feel like it, once life goes back to normal, whatever normal looks like and whenever that might be, that Quibi might be more appealing to you, or do you just feel like it doesn't, it's just not something that has, you know, gotten you excited at all, regardless of the circumstances?
I feel like my bar is like so high already to download a new app that it probably is not going to interest me. Like, I think I hate to admit it, but FOMO plays a role. So, because I'm a human and I don't have FOMO for Quibi, Clubhouse maybe, and I don't want to bring up Clubhouse because it's a whole other like conversation to have. But yeah, I guess my short answer is probably not going to be a comeback for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm in the same boat. I just don't know what on there I feel like I would miss if it was gone. Like did this happen yet, Anthony? Did they release their update about that they promised, that Katzenberg promised in that interview this week for the TV?
Not that I saw. So he was promising that it would start working on TVs, which I assume was not going to be a native TV app, but rather, you know,
it was AirPlay. Yeah. Because it was iOS exclusive initially. So like, that was my, like, I'll give you this chance. Like, if that comes out and I'll watch, I know Jordan is a big fan of Dangerous Game, for instance, the Hemsworth vehicle. And I am interested enough in the zany performance of the German guy.
Christoph Waltz.
Christoph Waltz in the first clip of that that I would want to follow it through, but that's about all. Oh, Reno 911. I love the original Reno 911. I don't know anything about this reboot. I would probably try that out on TV, but you know, it would have a high bar, like Natasha was saying, like really high bar that I would have to pass, even with like an actual consumption model that I wanted to use. Right?
It does seem like fundamentally they were so, at least from a marketing standpoint, they were so invested in this idea of just getting people excited about the idea of Quibi rather than a specific show. And I just think that is like misunderstanding what most consumers want, which is that if you were talking about FOMO, Natasha, and I just feel like you don't get FOMO because somebody is, I mean, Netflix and Disney Plus might be the one exceptions, but any of these other services, not, you don't get FOMO at the service. You might get a FOMO about everyone's talking about Handmaid's Tale or everybody's talking about this specific program. And I don't think Quibi has reached that threshold yet. Maybe they will. I mean, I think what I said, I think during our initial review is like, you know, they've got enough money that they can experiment a bit. Although I think they'll probably end up burning a lot of it in content production. Deals, although obviously yeah. that's, they got a bit of a pause on that, a little bit of a break on that. So we'll see. I think that, you know, if Quibi is going to succeed, and I feel like with consumer products, it's just so impossible to tell or to guess because luck plays such a big role too. But if they're going to succeed, it'll be very different from what we see today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But speaking of shows that hopefully maybe are getting some people excited and a little bit of FOMO, let's move on to our review of Never Have I Ever. And Natasha, you were actually the one who first suggested we review it, although I started to get excited already beforehand, but this kind of pushed us in that direction. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the show?
Yeah, so Never Have I Ever is the new Mindy Kaling produced show that is on Netflix, and it basically takes you through this tale of this Indian American teenager named Devi living with her mom and her super gorgeous cousin. And it's about how she lost her dad to a heart attack and is now also kind of this teenager that's going through all these teenage problems, like boys, friends, wanting to have sex for the first time. And it's, yeah, just kind of this classic immigrant child story meshed with being a teenager. So had to comment about it. So, yeah.
What was it that made you watch in the first place? Was it the Mindy Kaling connection? Did you feel like you like totally related to the character?
I think so many people were talking about it. So yes, to your FOMO point earlier. And also, I mean, I have always seen Indian American characters be secondary characters. So to see one in the spotlight, I was like, I have to support it. Even if I don't care about another show, like I'm going to give Netflix the usage so they keep making more Indian American focused shows.
I think we've talked about that phenomenon here before, like just watching something, even if you don't love it. So that Netflix is like, just keep making things like this. Like, please. Like, I'm just
give you this.
Yeah. Jordan once asked for people to watch. Well, I forget what show it was, another, but just put it on the background and just like go out of the room, like whatever. Just boost the numbers.
That is 100% exactly what I was trying to do when I first started watching it. I actually watched the first episode, put it off because I was annoyed by it. But then I was like, I need to get a chance.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I had a similar reaction to the early on. I found the first episode tested my patience. We're not doing our opinions yet necessarily, but like, sure, and then after that, I was hooked. Like it became something that I just binge watched basically after that. But the first one was difficult and tested my patience a bit.
Yeah, same. What about you, Anthony? What were your thoughts on the first episode?
I guess I didn't have that experience. I feel like I was pretty much on board from the start. I think like for me it was mostly just because it was so funny. I mean, and I think one of the things that's really challenging that we've hit up a couple times on this podcast is like, to a certain extent, funny stuff is really hard to sort of talk about or analyze because you just say, yep, it was funny. But the show is very, very funny. And I was laughing out loud from the start. I mean, one of the things maybe I struggled with a little bit is that it's established pretty much from the beginning that Debbie's father died. And that's the part of what she's coming into her sophomore year with this idea of like, last year was shit, this year is going to be great. And part of that is because, the big thing is the death of her father. And I was not very excited about that storyline. I was worried that it was just going to be a very perfunctory, piece of trauma for her to, you know, that she just gives her some pathos, but they weren't really going to do anything worthwhile with it as a, you know, from a storytelling perspective. And I feel like the show actually, I mean, I don't know that it does anything radically unusual with depicting how she deals with grief and getting over her father's death, but I do think it does much better and focuses on it much more than I was expecting.
Yeah, it didn't like dip a toe in and then kind of like use it as the background like tension, which I really appreciated too. And I honestly feel like I was more interested in her dad and her mom's story much more than her own story because okay. They were just both badasses. Like, I just thought that that was those flashbacks, I always lived for them. But that was mostly just out of like fangirling versus like any death necessarily.
Yeah. I was glad they brought him back because he was I remembered him from Heroes and I was like, oh, I like that actor. And then when in the first episode, it's not giving away because it's part of the preview, like when he dies, like it's like, or when they flash back to it, it's like, oh no, is he gone now? Like, is the actor that I liked just not going to be in the show anymore? But then, yeah, the flashbacks bring him back. So it's nice.
Mm-hmm. What do you guys think was hard for you about the first episode that made it a little bit not exciting?
For me, it felt like now in retrospect, it feels like they started with the characters kind of fully fleshed out maybe or something, or like, because I felt strange about all the characters. I was like, I don't really know who you are, and you all just seem to be enunciating a lot, like really, really clearly. And it seemed a bit wooden, but also like they had depth that they hadn't earned yet or something. I don't know. It was hard to put my finger on, but it seemed like not super well put together. Like maybe they had gone back and reshot the first, or the first was shot like quite a bit separately from the rest. They just felt, everything else felt a lot more natural and a lot more deserved in terms of like the big plot points, right? Like, and they threw a lot at you in that first episode, and it was a bit of like, oh, what's happening over here? What's happening here? Like, oh, her father died. Oh, she has unexplained like paralysis, like all these things. And you're like, what is going on? Like, there's a lot there, right? And I just needed to like catch my bearings a bit, I think.
Yeah, I kind of had a similar experience. Like I phrase it as like the moment I started watching it, I was kind of on the defense from the first scene because it was Devi praying. While I'm not Hindu or I'm Catholic, so I guess I can't perfectly like associate with it, just to clarify, but I guess immediately I was like, oh my god, they're just gonna like stick to main stereotypes and keep it really surface level in that way. So I was immediately on the defense being like, I don't want to watch another show that doesn't represent like the accurate aspect of growing up as an Indian American teenager. So that's why I turned it off like 20 minutes in. I was like, I'm not invested in the characters. You're relying on like these stereotypes. But then I was kind of like, you know, representation period is probably important. And I'm so glad I turned it back on, because the moment I stopped trying to be critical out the gate, I was like, all right, I can watch this with a little softer eyes, and it's really enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I struggle with in terms of a lot of immigrant narratives, or like, you know, for like second generation immigrant narratives and growing up as like an Asian American, narratives about that, like, is, and I mean, I guess one of the big examples I can think of is The Big Sick, but I think there's like a number of other stories that have elements of this, where instead of treating the Asian American character as this very stereotypical nerd or, you know, this other, they make them aggressively American. And so, and then the culture that their parents come from becomes this thing they have to fight against and resist and break free of, which I think is a real experience. And not to say that that's not a story that should be told, but I think that becomes sort of almost like the new stereotype is about the story of having to break free of this old culture and become, you know, American. And I like that this show, I mean, I think that's in this show, and that's a big part of the tension, but I feel like it makes it pretty, there's enough specifics to the relationship between Devi and her mother and the larger family that it feels like it has a lot of those story elements, but it never feels super familiar or like it's just sort of hitting these story points that you've seen a lot before.
Yeah, I agree. I think like their one scene about how like Indians don't believe in therapy really resonated with me, and it was both recognizable but also like, hey, I've never seen this on TV before, of like the mom basically was like, therapy's for white people, like we don't do therapy in this house. But the whole time Devi had been in therapy because of her dad dying. And I thought that was a really nice topic for them to touch on too. So I think like the show was based off of Mindy Kaling's life loosely, and you do see that realisticness of it coming through. Like, it was written by someone who had obviously lived some of these core experiences. So I think that's why I was like, okay, some of these stereotypes are well done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it had a lot of richness in the characterization, and like it helps by having like a lot of different characters to focus on. Like, they don't just follow her story, right? Like, they follow her cousin's story, her mom's story, and they all have like very different ones, and none of them are cartoonish in their characterization, right? Like, none of them are like super ultra orthodox, or like Anthony was saying, like super ultra rebellious. Like, there's a complicated mix of all of that going on, and it was nice to see.
Do you guys have favorite or least favorite supporting characters?
Ooh,
favorite or least favorite? I mean, I'm weirded out by the John McEnroe narration thing.
Oh no, I love that. Yeah. That's one of my favorite.
I don't think it worked. But okay, tell us why.
No, I think this is probably why. Because I think the John McEnroe narration is one of the first things you hear, or it is the first thing you hear. Yeah. On the show, and it's a huge part of the first episode or two, and then I think it's still there, but it recedes a little bit. So that's probably part of why I was on board from the beginning and you guys were not. And yeah, I'm not gonna say that it's like amazing, right? I just think it was so unexpected for me. I also just like John McEnroe, and
I really like John McEnroe too. That's why but then it was weird for me, because especially as the show goes on, you're like, what's he talking about? Like, isn't this weird and wrong? Like, why is he talking about this thing?
It's again like assuming that what you said before of like assuming that we're like already in the loop when we're not in the loop yet. Yeah. I don't think we get into the loop for a while. Yeah. Not to give anything away, but it's just like, what? But yeah, slightly distracting.
There's one specific way that they play. Well, there's two specific ways that they play with the narration, which we can talk more about in spoilers, that I thought were really good, though. That, like,
Definitely
by the end, I was just like, this narration is fine. I don't really have strong. At the beginning, I was like, this is great. John McEnroe, like, for no reason, beautiful. Like, I'm into it. But then later on, I just sort of didn't feel strongly about it. But then once in a while, when they would surprise you with the narration, I thought that was, I would really enjoy that.
Right. But she also started to narrate at some point in some parts.
Did she?
Yeah, just very briefly, or it was bad ADR, but it sounded like narration. Like, it might have been bad post-production ADR, and it was supposed to be in scene, but it really confused the hell out of me, because I was like, is she narrating this moment all of a sudden? And when did she become able to do that? And there was only a couple of moments, but I think there was a
times where it feels like she's talking, and then they cut to something else, but you still hear her voice or something like that.
Yeah.
So there's like,
yeah. Like, they cut away to another character, and then it sounds like they just dubbed over it in a studio after, but didn't go out of their way to make it sound like it was shot on scene along with her actual dialogue. Maybe that's what it is. It might be a strictly technical issue, but it was off-putting, because I was like, is she a narrator all of a sudden? But yeah.
I'm trying to think of my favorite character. I feel like her mom was kind of like, is great actress, but I just think her mom was like the most underrated character of the show. Like, I think that she kept showing up with these really witty one-liners and really did the whole Indian mom character so well. I was like, yes, like, you are my mom. I am like getting so many flashbacks. And I thought that she like didn't, you know, because like she in the show, she's like from India and moved to the States. Like, I think like in some ways I was less like critical of her than I was of the Indian American, who I would more closely resemble with, because I was like, yeah, you're my mom and this sounds right.
Yeah. I thought the mom did a great job performance wise overall. So she was definitely a highlight. It had a really good supporting cast overall. Like, I don't think anybody did a terrible job. Niecy Nash as the therapist was surprisingly good and effective too.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. She grew on me for sure.
Yeah.
One thing I also really liked about the high school cast is I think. I mean, I don't know if this is as universal as it used to be, but Daryl, I feel like when you and I were growing, like watching teenage shows, like growing up, and high school shows growing up, like it was just given that every actor at the high school would be a 21-year-old.
Yeah, right.
And they would look like a 20, and you just sort of accepted the fact. And they were written as if they were mini adults. And I think this is both the acting and the writing I'm talking about now, is I feel like this show does a good job of showing that you're not like just a little kid anymore, but you're not an adult yet. And,
yes.
And you still like, in some ways, it's also a lot closer to my experience as a, you know, somewhat awkward, nerdy high school student, where I feel like I would watch these high school movies where people were like just getting, like having sex and making out and drinking beer. And it wasn't necessarily that big a deal. And some of those things do happen in the show, but it's actually like a huge deal to them, because most of the time when it's happening, it's the very first time it's happening. And I love that it actually captures that sort of in-betweenness of being a teenager.
Yeah, I think, like, I mean, I imagine you're invoking kind of like the She's All That era of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But even one we covered recently, like the Ryan Murphy one.
The politician.
Yeah, like obviously he has a weird skewed perspective that is a little bit outside of or parallel to reality, right? But like this felt so real and like true to actual adolescent experience, like in the way that people would do things that you're like, that's so unnecessarily cruel, but also like I can definitely remember moments when I was unnecessarily cruel just because I didn't have a good fully built out empathy function, or like I didn't understand like the ramifications of my actions, or you know, it was a novel experience for me, so I didn't know what was going to happen. And I thought this was great for that. I thought there was like, there was people being like really offensive to themselves and to other people that were like felt like real moments too, right? Like nothing was like pacified or like had the edges sanded down in the way that you would typically see in like a teen comedy or something like this.
Yeah, I feel like when I saw Davy the first scene, and I saw that she didn't have like perfectly arched eyebrows and a winged eyeliner, I was like, let's go. Because it was, yeah, I think that's another reason why it was such an important show for any minority to watch too, like especially growing up. Like I grew up on High School Musical and Gossip Girl, and like I owe all my self-esteem issues to both of those shows naturally. So to see someone that is, you know, beautiful but not like stereotypical and beauty wise is really exciting. I'm like, hell yeah.
Right. I don't want to like exaggerate how realistic or unattractive the cast is, because they're all like, you know, they all look like professional actors and have professional good looks. And like, you know, that I feel like they talk more about like ugliness and like things like arm hair and things than actually show you. Although there is one episode where a pimple plays a really big role. Oh, yeah. And I thought it was a very enjoyably ugly pimple.
But then it
like creates this baseline where then, because everyone's pretty attractive, and this is true of like a lot of like high school movies where like there's like the unpopular girl, the ugly girl, and you're kind of like, I don't know if in a real high school that's how people would feel about it. Although I think a lot of social dynamics really don't have to do with just, you know, your sort of natural attractiveness, and there's other things at play. But like because everyone is pretty attractive, then there's this character Paxton who she has a crush on, and like he is the one who's just like preposterously, right, like so ripped and so good looking, and he's the one thing where you're just like, yeah, okay, this is a little over the top, but you know,
distractingly so for sure. Yeah. It's like, oh my god.
They do a good job of making it true like in fiction though too, so that everybody comments on it, like including Niecy Nash and like the parents, and like everybody is like, yeah, this is absurd. Like this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. There are a couple of characters, I mean, primarily Paxton, but then also Kamala, her cousin, and then another guy who shows up later, who like, there's like a lot of like double takes when people are like, oh my God, that they're so like attractive. And I will say that all of the actors cast in those roles, you're like, yep. Yep, that, yeah. I see that. That's how I'd respond in real life, for sure.
Right.
Yeah, I think Kamala's probably my least favorite character.
Huh.
Because I just think that, I don't know. Something that like I'm a little frustrated by from this show is that they cast a, like, I guess in the Indian culture, like, being light-skinned is considered more beautiful, and they really leaned into that with Kamala's casting. I would have loved to see someone of a darker skin tone, potentially, but I think that that, in some way, maybe it was her, Mindy Kaling trying to, like, note that, but to me it was just like, oh, why does, like, the prettiest Indian in the show, or what they want you to think is the prettiest Indian in the show, have to be light skin? Was kind of like, meh.
Right. I think you sort of justify it because it's not just the prettiest, but the one who registers as pretty to the American people around her. And so it's sort of, but yeah, I see what you mean, that it's sort of a very kind of like predictable, you know, kind of pat kind of casting.
Yeah, it is hard because you can see Mindy Kaling making that decision, or whoever was in charge of casting, because for the reason you say, right, where it's like, well, this is like a prevailing stereotype and she wants to be accurate to the stereotypes of the culture, but then she doesn't bring up anything to frustrate that image or idea, right? So
yeah, I wish we'd seen one scene of like Fair and Lovely or something about how it would, I think that would 100% have solved that distaste.
I would say that in general, like, I mean, partly they can get away with this because every, you know, all the cast members are fairly attractive, is that, and I don't think this is the first show or even unique at this point, but again, as somebody who's like been watching, you know, high school drama for a long time, it's just really refreshing that it seems like racial and ethnic dynamics don't play a major role, that like, there can be like a beautiful Indian woman who's like in love with this guy, like, you know, Chinese or other like East Asian guy from Caltech, and like that there's no need to like comment on that or have that be a big thing, and that, you know, no one, it feels like they're slotted into particular romantic possibilities because of their race or ethnic background, which seems like a really low bar, but it did feel like for the longest time it was always like, okay, here are the two Asian characters, they will get together, here are the two and then like the two really attractive white leads, they will get together, and it feels like this really like does a good job of scrambling that.
Yeah, that was a pretty big staple of that era of movies that you were talking about, or like the era of shows that you were talking about, right? Like
that there's usually at least you know, a black male and female friend who would get together, and then maybe an Asian male and female friend who would also get together.
Yeah, and the implication was like, great, they found each other. Like, it was like, it was like really offensive in retrospect, but at the time, I think we were just like, right, I don't know, this is how media works. Like,
I thought that was how love worked.
Right. Yeah.
Are there other things you should say about the show before we move into spoilers?
I would just say that it's like, I like, I think the episode length is like, what, around like 20 something minutes each. So it's like in 10 episode total season, like really watchable, length. And I think it's perfect. Like they feel like they contain a lot, and yet they also, don't drag on or anything like that. So I really liked the format that they use.
Right. It's something that conceivably, if you love it, you could just like finish it all in one night.
Yeah, you could do it in a day.
What I did, for sure. I did it on a Friday night with my boyfriend, and we just went through it. It was amazing.
Yeah, it's really fun. I'm a huge fan. I'm really glad I watched it. Let's move into spoilers. So if you have not seen the entire first season of Never Have I Ever and you don't want to know what happens, you should stop listening now. And maybe the obvious thing to talk about in spoilers is the romantic subplot. So there's a character named Ben, who is introduced early on as Davi's rival in school. And I think pretty early on, like by the end of the first episode, I was like, are they trying to set the two of them up? I feel like they're probably trying to set the two of them up.
Yeah.
And then it's really cemented when there's an episode, episode 6, which is actually told from his point of view. And that was one of the narrator things I liked, was that for that episode, they swapped the narrator and they brought Andy Samberg in.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
Yeah, and you just sort of see how, okay, so we like Andy Samberg, we don't like John McNamara.
No. Listen, the John McNamara thing, I still don't know entirely how I feel about it. Because it was like,
it's complex.
I like John McEnroe, I like the show separately. Then them together is weird.
Yeah.
But.
And then it sort of turns into a sort of classic love triangle where Ben and Davi like develop like a friendship, and then, well, first he tries to kiss her and she doesn't seem interested, and then it sort of develops, and then Paxton, who at the beginning she was pining for and then decided she was going to propose casual sex with him, which he was fine with until I think they kind of became more involved. And then anyway, like, there are more convolutions in that, but ultimately both of them are interested in her. Did you guys like feel invested in the romantic storylines?
I didn't want her and Ben to be a storyline romantically. Like, I kind of loved them as, you know, at odds with each other. So I kind of was sad when I saw that happen, because I was like, damn it, don't make it all about this relationship. Like, we could have had this go for like another couple seasons. Mm-hmm. And like, maybe down the road. So that was something that I wasn't a huge fan of. But I did like that neither of them ended up having sex. None of them ended up having sex. I was like, nice, we completely skipped that.
For now. I mean, we'll see for what now. Happens in future seasons.
Yeah, it made it less about the whole show, I guess.
Yeah, I thought it was, I like their like evolution, and I like the UN episode especially, and like,
oh yeah. Yeah,
they had a great relationship and interplay, and then I think the first romantic move he makes is like he tries to kiss her at his birthday party at his place, and then I was kind of like, oh man, like, why, it didn't have to go here, like, you already had a really good like arc with their relationship, and this was the easy way for it to go, and it would have been nicer if they didn't do that, right? Like, I guess they felt like they had to set up an opposition between like him, her, and what was the other guy's
Paxton
name? Paxton, yeah. So like they needed some kind of like tension there, but like you could have had a fine tension with just like her realizing maybe she doesn't want to date this guy, or and having conflict with just that, right? Like an internal conflict instead of like is this one or this one conflict, right?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't feel like when they kissed at the end of the season, I wasn't like, yes, at last, like this right. is, you know, what I've been waiting for the whole time, but it also felt like in a way that that's what they'd been building towards. I mean, and again, especially when we got the episode from his Ben's perspective, I was just like, oh yeah, they're definitely like going to get together, because like, why would you do this unless, why would you sort of single him out as the one other character who got a viewpoint episode unless they're going to get together? But I think that it would have been cool if they'd subverted that and instead like it had been about them building a friendship, or rather than, you know, just having it turn into a romance and then a romantic triangle. I will say I liked that Ben, even when he's being sort of heroic in that and just like, or at least like a really good friend / boyfriend material in that final episode, I like that he's still kind of ridiculous, and that whole thing where he's like, no, I will get you to Malibu, and because they're going to Malibu to try to, so that the Davi can be there when her mother scatters her father's ashes. And it just seems like this amazing heroic thing that he's doing. Well, not amazing, but like a really nice thing he's doing, because he's also done these other things where he's convinced her friends to come and reconcile, and then get her to go to the scattering of the ashes. But then we cut to him in his car, and he's just going, or his dad's car, and he's just going so slowly. And yeah, I like that he's still kind of a ridiculous goofball.
He snuck up on me. Like, I think it took till that episode for me to really be like, I have a soft spot for you, Ben, but that episode sealed the deal. I was like, you're freaking adorable and like, you're such a nerd and it works for you. So, you know, as I didn't really need them to be romantic, I'm rooting for him in any way, like for the next season, which hopefully happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a strong character. I think I thought the episode of that was focused on him really did do a good job of making him sympathetic. I think it was like effective. If I think back on it, I'm kind of like, why was it effective? Like, it's a little bit like, I feel bad for him, but at the same time, he's very, very privileged. So like, should I feel bad for him? Right? Like
ever? Yeah.
I feel like sad, lonely, rich boy is a pretty common trope too. It was like a big thing in Gossip Girl. It was a big thing in Veronica Mars. I'm sure there are other things that I'm not thinking of too. And I think I was even aware of it partly because one of my friends who's a movie writer, she was tweeting about this, about how she's just like always a sucker for the sad rich boy. But he is very much in that mold. Although I like, again, that he's not, I think a lot of the other, if I think about like Chuck Bass and Gossip Girl or whatever, like, or Logan and Veronica Mars, like those sad rich boys tend to be much more brooding. And he is like just really nerdy and lonely.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's a different flavor.
Yeah, that is true. But it's also like not like he's, I guess his parents just seem casually damaging in that they're like not, they don't go out of their way to hurt his feelings. They just happen to in their own selfishness, you know, like where, and then, yeah, like the thing of the Clippers game is just now looking back on it, if you try to summarize it, it's like, that sounds ridiculous, right? If you're like, oh, but this guy, I mean, he couldn't find anybody to go with him courtside to the Clippers game. It's like, so?
So
I mean,
he had to give the tickets to his housekeeper. It was yeah. So sad.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So, yeah, it's not really, his situation is not actually that tragic.
No, but I still found him, I was like, oh, I like this character. And, I mean, maybe it's because I definitely knew, there's one person in particular I knew growing up who was very, very similar. Like, he was a friend of mine, and we would do the same thing where his parents were always like out and would just like go do social functions and stuff. And you'd go over to his place, and then they would be like, all right, so we're going out. Here's $500. Like, get pizza. And I was always like, what the fuck is going on? Is this real?
Not a smile.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'd be like, yeah, this is normal. That's a normal amount of money for you to give us to get pizza. And so I recognize that there, but like, as much as that guy was a friend, like, I feel like he was less of a good person when it came to other people than Ben is. So that makes him sympathetic in a way where I'm like, you know, you could have all this privilege and end up a far worse person than this guy does, and he ends up a pretty good person who behaves nicely to other people when it comes down to it, right? Like, at first he's definitely combative and stuff, but like, he's still nice at heart, and he still like goes out of his way to like help people, which makes him sympathetic, I think, right? You can't help your circumstances, and he happens to have good circumstances, but he comes out all right. So
I would say that in contrast, Paxton is still a little bit of a cipher. Like, he's very good looking again, and that seems to be his predominant characteristic for the first few episodes. And then we find out a little bit about his sister and that he seems like a decent guy, but like, as a character, to me, he feels much more like a blank than Ben does.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, he's more like, yeah, exactly. He's a cipher, or just like a plot mover for other things. He doesn't really seem to have much of his own thing. Like, you get, and they really, in the show, I think they could address this more. Like, he gets a lot of kudos just for basically being human to her.
Yeah, so true.
Which is, like, not cool, right? But, like, it is hard to do, especially in that climate. And they play this for laughs most of the time, but his one buddy with the long hair, like, shows some of the real callousness that they, like, when Ben is like, hey, dude, and he just gives him that, like, face and is like, like, walks past him. Like, that's the level you're dealing with, right? So anything above that is kind of an achievement, as much as it sucks to say it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that the bar is probably a lot lower for teenage boys.
Yeah.
One other thing I wanted to touch on was then they also sort of resolve the, I mean, you know, I assume there'll be more of this, at least the mother-daughter relationship, but I thought the way that sort of developed over the course of the season and how that's also about like the grief for her father was all like well done. And again, it's one of those things where if I look back, I'm like, no, that feels like pretty much what I expected would happen. It was written in a way that wasn't terribly surprising or original, but all of it was done well enough that I have to admit that in the scene where they're scattering her dad's ashes and then they're playing Beautiful Day, which is like kind of an on the nose song choice that they, as soon as they play Beautiful Day at the beginning of the episode, they're going to bring that back. I know they're going to bring that back. And they did. But I was crying. I was definitely
same.
Really surprised at how moved I was.
Yeah, the ending scene to me also, I feel like, was super emotional, and I did not think I was going to cry because it was a light lift show overall. And they also were like praying in Tamil, I believe, and it was just like this really beautiful scene that I was like, damn, you just really snuck up again and got me.
Damn, this is where I wish I finished all the episodes.
Oh, no, sorry. Yeah, I forgot that you had
no, finished. It's all right. It's all right. I'm 1.5 away, but it'll probably still be just as emotional. I read the synopsis, too, because I'm doing their duty to the listener instead of sacrificing my own enjoyment.
Yeah.
One other love dynamic I wanted to get your guys' mm-hmm. thoughts on was with Nalini, who was dating this guy and then was put up for an arranged marriage. And something I liked, there was one thing I liked, one thing I didn't like, I'll stick with what I liked. It was her being okay with the arranged marriage, kind of, at the end of it. I kind of loved that she changed the conversation against how arranged marriages are like not modern and don't do well to like the super hot guy came to the door and she was like, all right, maybe I'm into it. And it was just it was different than what you usually see when I was growing up with arranged marriages being what you had to do and it's sad.
Yeah, I thought it was, again, sort of gently subverting what you were expecting. And that it wasn't just that it was the hot guy who shows up, but that it becomes very clear that she and the hot guy are very, very well matched to each other.
Mm.
And so, and of course, at the same time, the boyfriend that she's with is not exactly coming off particularly well in this episode because he's like snuck into her bedroom to try to stop her from doing this in this way that seems very whiny and I mean maybe from a certain angle it seems romantic, but at least it does not come off that way to me. And so at that point I was like, yeah, like, you know, why not, like, try out this other guy. And that it's not and then at the end it's not like, yes, let us go through with this arranged marriage. It's like, hey, let's try to date each other and see where this goes.
Yeah, I thought that was good. I think that goes back to the way that they like didn't, nothing was just like, oh yeah, this is good and this is bad, right? And it's way different than the, like, this is maybe off track, but like growing up in school in Canada, we were always taught like, this is just like grade school all the way up. They were like, okay, so what's the difference between America and Canada? And the answer was, America's a melting pot, Canada's a mosaic. And they drilled that into us from like, from when we were like in kindergarten on, right? And what it meant was, if you went to America, they wanted to make you same American. Like there was a blandness, and it was basically like, throw it all into a blender and then just like make sure it all comes out beige, right? Whereas if you came to Canada, like what we did was respect people's cultures and they could keep them intact, like when they came and joined, so that it was like a puzzle piece of like, and that was like, I don't know where that came from or what part of curriculum that was, or if it's still a thing that they teach here. I never even realized that, because I'm a kid, right? Like I didn't realize that there was no, that probably wasn't a reversed thing. Like in the States, I'm sure they weren't like, so yeah, guess what? Like, we're a melting pot, and over in Canada they're a mosaic. They don't say anything
about
Canada.
We're definitely not the melting pot.
Part of it was also because I don't know that we spent a lot of time talking about what the situation was in Canada.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. I think we spent a lot more time talking about that for obvious reasons. But yeah, so like for me, media always reflected that, right? Like especially in the kind of 90s shows and like coming of age stories and things like that, and like, there was this tension, but there was a clear winner. Like there was a progression path, and it was towards, what do you call it? Like
assimilation.
Assimilation. It was towards assimilation, and that was the positive progression path, right? In American media specifically. And this has like a great, like, no, fusion model. Like, let's see, maybe this is working better. Maybe like there are reasons this works here, and there are reasons this works here, and you can take what's good about everything and kind of combine it, right? And I thought that her storyline was really effective in doing that. I thought another nice moment they had was at the celebration, I forget the name of the festival, in like the early season, mid-season of the show.
Oh, Ganesh Puja?
Yeah, yeah. And she meets her old friend who's like at Caltech or somewhere, but he's like come back for it. And she was like, what happened? Like, I thought you were like, as soon as I get out of here, like, I'm never doing anything Indian again. Like, I'm just going to, like, be American, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, yeah, you'd think that. And then you realize like, oh, this is kind of nice, and like it's nice to have a community and whatever. And so that was like a nice, like, let's just make it explicit. It was kind of a tell don't show moment, which is like not strictly speaking great television, but I thought it was right. nice and like right. brought the point to
this guy
before,
you've never seen before and will never see and again we'll see on again. The show
yeah.
then
yeah.
explains this idea. But that was definitely my attitude towards my own like sort of cultural heritage of like when I was growing up, I was like, I don't want to be seen as Chinese or Asian American. I want to be seen as American, as essentially white, and I'm not interested in all this other stuff. And then at a certain point, I was like, oh, wait, that's like a pretty extreme attitude that is not actually the stance I want to take.
Yeah, same. I feel like it took until going to college for me to like start eating Indian food with happiness. But I did want to also point out, like, I think sometimes, like, a lot of times the lack of explicitness was nice and I think made it more accessible to everyone to watch. But I think sometimes it kind of came off problematic. Like, there was this one scene that I can't get over. It was when Kamala was meeting a woman who had gotten divorced. And the woman was Indian, had married a Muslim. And, you know, she was kind of like, I regretted marrying this Muslim man. And, like, for all intensive purposes, the Muslim conflict within, like, you know, my own life, within so many, like, within this, like, Indian diaspora community is, like, one of the most contentious issues and so deep. And to, like, kind of, like, just toe into the pool, it was kind of, I think, it came off bad. Because it's, like, if you're going to mention it, if you're going to mention, like, Modi or mention the Muslim conflict, I feel like you got to be explicit, because doing a lukewarm take on it is just, like, don't do that, because it's not good.
Right. And they really just brought it up to make... to give her something to think about, right? Like, it was a plot device for her character, which is a pretty cheap way,
yeah,
a throwaway way to use that subject. Yeah,
it deserves more for sure. And it felt like, just I guess I haven't seen too much criticism of it, so I wanted to make sure we talked about that a little bit too.
The way I think they sort of acknowledge that, or not that same thing, but I think what feels more productive is like, or like a better way to deal with it in the context of this comedy show that's not particularly interested in getting into like Indian history or Indian politics, is just acknowledging like that not everyone from India is Hindu. Like, it seems like that seems like, and that's part of what they do, and I think that's great. But yeah, then to like try to acknowledge, then you're starting to bring in more stuff than the show is really equipped to handle, at least in that episode.
Yeah, totally.
Do we have any final thoughts about Never Have I Ever?
No, I mean, I think it felt like a mix between, I don't know, like some of the stuff that like 30 Rock or something, but then also some other more kind of traditional sitcoms and things like that, but like in a really good way. Like, it had a lot of maturity of the comedy, but it didn't go on these crazy like the frenetic joke streams that those things go on, which tend to bring them into the world of the absurd, right? So it felt a lot more human to me, but it still felt like really funny in the moments where it was funny. And I think that's what I liked most about it. And I think it caught me by surprise too. Like, that was another really pleasant thing about it, was like moments where it felt really insightful or emotional or clever often were just like, wow, like I wasn't really expecting that there, based on kind of the assumptions that I had about how this was going to proceed. And so it was great. It kept it fresh, like as I was watching it, and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think like my biggest kind of takeaway from it was like, for all its weaknesses and not, it's not supposed to be fully inclusive of the entire Indian experience in the United States. The actress herself tweeted like, this is one story. Maitri Ramakrishna, who plays Devi, she tweeted like, this is one story. There are so many other stories waiting to be told. So, you know, I felt heard, and I felt like it was a realization that I need to not be out of the gate critical for any show that's trying to add to the conversation. And just kind of take it as it is and just hope that there's more to come.
Yeah, exactly. That I would hope that, I think sometimes, and I've been guilty of this too, is that like, if they make another comedy about a teenage, like an Indian American teenager girl, like you wouldn't like I think there's sometimes a temptation to be like, oh wait, no, we've got that, we've already like checked that box off, and instead to be like, no, like this is one kind of story about that experience, and or you know, it's one experience of like many, many different experiences. But overall, it's amazing because I think like I'm hard, aside from the humor, which I think is just like really spot on and really strong throughout, yeah, like everything else, like I wouldn't necessarily say that like any individual aspect of it was so amazing, but like the whole package just like totally works, and it was just like pure pleasure for me from beginning to end, except for a few moments, because I have a really hard time watching social awkwardness and confrontation, so there are times where I'd pull my shirt over my head and sort of be like, oh my god, but you know, even that was good in its own way. Well, with that, why don't I wrap it up? So before we go, I will just remind our listeners, they can always email us at originalcontent@techcrunch.com. If you have anything interesting to say about Never Have I Ever or about our review, we will read it on our next episode. You can also subscribe and leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or any other podcast app. Thank you for listening. Daryl and Natasha, thank you for joining me. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too.